On episode 85 of the InsurTech Geek Podcast, talking about starting up and scaling up InsurTech with Alex Bond from FinPro. The InsurTech Geek Podcast, powered by JB Knowledge, is all about technology that's transforming and disrupting the insurance world. We'll be interviewing guests and doing deep dives into specific tech we see changing the industry. We're taking you on a journey through insurance tech, so enjoy the ride and geek out. So, back to you, Alex Bond from FinPro. He's currently founder and CEO at FinPro, where he's been for the last 7 years. So, you dreamed of being a fighter pilot. You grew up outside of London. You go to college for business management, and then you jump straight into commercial insurance claim.
Well, you're looking at the rose-tinted glasses LinkedIn version of my career. So there was a point in time where I fell out with my parents when I used to work in cocktail bars, and I used to run bar consultancy. So I would go and design cocktail bar menus, and I would work in events, and I loved it. And I thought, this is what I'm going to do for a job. And my mother, let's be honest, was very disappointed.
To say the least, right?
Like... Yeah. She did not agree with me that Tom Cruise's Cocktail
was one of the greatest movies ever made, and I don't care what anybody says.
If you follow the theme of thinking, I'm essentially following Tom Cruise's career advice. Fighter pilot for Top Gun.
Yeah.
If that doesn't work, go into Cocktail.
When he used to throw the bottles, and they had the big bar there, and then he ends up, what a great movie. What a great movie.
It doesn't hold up quite as well, but I still love it. I've got a big affection for it.
Are you saying I need to watch it again to get a feel for what
you should happened? You should rewatch it. It's still fun. It's still a lot of fun. I mean, I'd still encourage people to watch it. But I did a lot of events things, and then I did that during college, and then at the end, and then my mum sort of was like, right, are you going to go and wear a suit to work, please? We didn't invest in your university for you to go and work in a bar. So, and insurance is the same story like everyone else. I walked into an open day for RSA that were hiring people in claims, and you know, they offered me the princely sum of, I don't know, it's equivalent of about $20,000 a year, and I was like, I'm rich, let's go. And so I just stumbled into it like everyone else. That's my origin story.
Yeah, you're like, hey, why not? It sounds like a lot of money right now. It does sound like a lot of money when you're eating grilled cheese sandwiches. And let's talk about how you wound up. You went to commercial insurance claims at RSA, then you went to manager insurance team London at Hays, then you went to the manager at Eames Consulting Group. I mean, what were you learning through all this? Like, what lines of business did you work in? What parts of the insurance business did you really get to know before you jumped into what you're doing now?
Hays is my first recruitment job. So I didn't even make a full year in insurance. I was doing commercial claims. I was working with broking clients who had large fleets. I was doing a lot of auto. And I loved the client interaction. I loved managing the clients, even when they were being difficult or demanding or hard work. I liked that side of it. And then I had a chat with my boss, and I thought there was a role called the claims relationship manager. And I said, I really want that role. And they said, oh, we can see you doing that in about 6 years' time. and that role was paying like $50,000, and I'm like, I'm not waiting 6 years to earn $50,000. Like, absolutely no chance. Yeah. So I couldn't get out of there quick enough. So I had two guys that I knew at university. They were doing really well in the recruitment sector. So I started having a look for opportunities, and then I was contacted by Hays, and they had, because I had this 9 months experience in insurance, they were like, well, you're an insurance expert. So you can come and work in our insurance recruitment team. And then I've stayed in the sector from a recruitment perspective in various different guises ever since. So
he must know what he's doing. He worked there all of 9 months. Like, I feel, well, like, I mean, I feel like 9 months into my insurance journey that I was just trying to understand what the hell a policy was. Like,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I had no idea what a policy was, I don't think, at that point. Well, the first thing I did, so I specialized in claims recruitment because I kind of understood it. And I knew what everyone was getting paid at RSA because I was on the same wages. And then when QBE opened up down the road, MS Amlin opened up down the road, and there was a couple of other businesses, one called Highway. There was all these competing businesses. And I found out what they were all paying. So I just would phone my old colleagues and go, did you know you can get $5,000 more if you move down the road? And so I think I moved 9 people from my old team within the first 6 months. So I wasn't very popular at RSA, but they wouldn't take me on as a client. So bad luck for them. And I started well.
Suck it up.
yeah, exactly. Pay the money or move along. And but no, I loved it. I've loved recruitment ever since I've started it. I love that client interaction, you know, and it's very unfiltered. Yeah, and you're providing a need, right? So companies can't grow if they can't attract talent, and if you can be the solution to that, then it's a nice relationship to have. So yeah, it's been that way since I joined Hays. Back, I don't even know the date. I think you've got it in front of you. I don't think I could tell you what year I started.
Yeah, no, 2007. Yeah.
There we go. So, 15 years.
So, I mean, but, you know, let's just talk about headhunting for a second. I'm not a big fan of headhunters, okay? I mean, you have some that are really good. And, man, you seem like a good guy. You know, you seem like a good guy. You got an industry where you got a lot of colleagues who just intentionally churn accounts. You know, they move people around because they generate fees off of movement. There's no fee generation if you put people there and just keep them there forever, and you do a great job of driving turnover down at your clients. And so there are markets where headhunters get really, really, really aggressive and just churn the hell out of the labor market in that area.
Well, firstly, I don't believe what you just said is true. So we've got to start there.
Maybe you haven't seen the IT market in the United States.
Well, I was going to say the technology market is a market where it's closest to being true.
Yeah.
But you can't move happy people that are paid the appropriate wage for the market. You can't do that. Like, we're not magicians. We can't whisper in people's ear and magic them away.
Yeah.
We don't have that power, but we can present opportunities that pay more, that might have better incentives for them, that might have a better mission for them to be on. And if you as a business can't, unfortunately, if you can't match that, then they are probably likely to move. But people do move for money, but rarely. So it's usually about them kind of feeling more involved, more invested. So, but look, there are people that play the game badly. There's no getting away from that. I've worked with a few of them. I don't work with them anymore. And I think that's where I think the distinction comes. If you're genuinely an executive search person, you will have off limits with your clients, and you won't, you can't place someone in a business and then with the other hand be raiding them for some talent. It's just not the way the game should be played.
Yeah.
And I think there's a difference there. The tech market is notoriously ruthless.
And that's been my unfortunate, experience level. It's not with insurance placement. It's been with technology. And I've just watched these tech headhunters just churn and churn and cherry pick from their own accounts and then move the people they already moved in and recruit them back off. I mean, and you watch people bounce, between jobs every 2 years, and it creates just an incredible amount of trauma. But the reality is, I'm also a regent at a public university, and I was a city councilor in my city, and I have very, very, very effectively used executive search in those roles. And could not, by the way, have done my job without the executive search. So there's always, I've got a flip side to every story. That's why I like to ask you where you've seen it. And of course, you've seen it in tech as well. Why do you think tech is so prone to this type of executive headhunting behavior?
Well, firstly, I would draw a distinction. I would say that's kind of like contingent recruitment behavior.
Contingent, correct. Well, not executive search, not retained. Yeah, it's not retained search. It's contingent search. Yeah.
And so I think that's important because they are different methods of of attack, as it were, for a recruitment professional. The reason we've seen it is because the wage inflation is so dramatic in tech. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even in the last 2 years, you're talking about wage inflation of such a high level that it's very difficult for you as a business. You've hired some people, they've been with you 2 years, you've given them fair pay rises, but the market has decided that the new fair increase is 40% above what you're paying. So what do you do? And I have massive sympathy, because you can't turn around and pay everyone 40% more, or because you would have priced your contracting work,
correct,
or you would have priced your products.
You have to reprice all your customers, yeah.
Exactly, it's all built in. So you've got to just, unfortunately, accept that some people will get those opportunities externally that are paying 40% more and move. And I think that's why you've seen it in tech, because it's you know, the tech salaries have kind of been reflective of the tech, you know, opportunities in the kind of public investment markets. I mean, the growth has just been astronomical. I mean, we hear stories of the big, you know, the big tech companies hiring people straight from college and paying $300,000. You know, for the best engineering talent, and you know, what do you do with that? I mean, that would put you at sort of a fairly senior stack in an insurance company, and you know, sometimes you'd be better off going to university and learning engineering than learning anything about insurance and sticking with it. So I think that's why we've seen it. But then it's interesting for me, because in the US there are more recruitment companies in the whole of London than there are the whole of the US.
Whoa.
Yeah. It is. London is the most aggressive recruitment market in the world.
Is that because of birth rates and you just have like a straight up labor shortage? I mean, we're seeing. No. In all honesty, yeah, we're seeing in Western Europe, we're seeing birth rates so low that you end up with more workers retiring than workers coming into the labor market, right? So that naturally compresses your available supply of talent. Is it just because it's a really mature industry there, or is it because you literally are having labor shortages across multiple industry verticals?
It's more of the latter, that there's it's just a mature industry here. It's a much more mature industry. It's been around for a long time, and the problem, you know, it's a very low barrier to entry business. So you can work in recruitment for a couple of years, you probably know the bare basics, you can leave, you can set up in your bedroom and off you go. So anyone that gets good at it probably usually looks to set up on their own. So you've got this kind of constant evolution of new businesses coming in. I mean, there's something like 70% of all recruitment businesses are less than 10 people. So it's lots of small businesses. But then there, of course, is a labor shortage as well. I mean, I won't get too political, but we've not been too astute in our education system from a sort of top-down government perspective, so we're lagging behind in things like engineering. You know, we've got a bit of a mess of an education system with respect to kind of what's needed in the current work environment. So I think that's becoming more of an issue. And then when we do stupid things like leave the EU and make that harder for everyone, you know, we're not
guess who's in any.
If you're in business and you're not in, then you've either made too much money so it's not a problem, or
or you're a very lucky person. Yes.
Yeah, you're a very lucky person. You're a very lucky person.
Well, it's a great, great conversation. So yeah. Rob Galbraith, what you got?
Yeah, Alex, so great to have you on. And I'm actually happy that the microphone is turned a bit, because you are a host of a podcast, Alex, and I've had the pleasure of being a guest on your podcast. So I've got some hard-hitting questions here for you, but very quickly, I wanted to give you the opportunity to just do a quick plug of your podcast, tell people what it's about, where to find it.
Oh, it's very kind of you. Yeah. So I run the Leadership and Insurance podcast. Both of these fine gentlemen have been guests at different times. We talk about innovation in insurance. We wanted to call it the Innovation Insurance Podcast, but one already exists, so don't subscribe to that one. But we wanted to we wanted to make sure that we were not excluding the traditional incumbent insurance industry, because innovation happens across the industry. And I think if you talk about, if you put innovation in the title, people leap to technology, but we don't just talk about technological innovation. We talk about innovative working practices. We talk about how to do innovation at scale. We talk about entrepreneurship. So anything where there's a sort of innovative edge within the insurance space, we have those guests on, and it's typically C-suite execs from, you know, the sort of insure tech market, but we have people that we like to term as futurists and authors like yourself, Rob, and then we have people running kind of technology businesses like James, and so we've had a variety of people from the very, very big. We've been lucky enough to get a few unicorns on through to the very small. As long as they're doing something interesting, then we always want to have them as a guest on the show.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Definitely check it out. One of the my favorite conversations of the podcast that I've had the pleasure to be a guest on. So thanks for the opportunity, Alex. So let's talk about the state of talent in the insurance industry. And I'm really specifically interested. We've talked a little bit about some of the incumbents, but what sort of talent are InsurTech startups looking to get, and how can these startups be effective in attracting the talent?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. So I spent, as we were saying, sadly, a long time in the recruitment sector in the insurance. So 15 years, and the last five have been, the last three truly, but five I've been kind of, you know, touching base with the insurtech industry, and what they've wanted has changed over time. There's been this evolution, and it follows the kind of evolution of what we saw in the insurtech market. So there was a lot of distribution plays, and therefore you needed people that could sell. You needed people who knew the insurance industry and could build partnerships. So they were taking a lot of talent there. And then now we're moving into a sort of product-led space where we're seeing a lot of kind of SaaS solutions, and we're seeing a lot of kind of product-led people joining. But we're also seeing a maturity of the market. So now there is a mature insurtech market. So people are moving from insurtech to insurtech. And I think both sides, insurance and technology businesses, are a little bit in love with their own state of being. So, you know, tech people sometimes think that insurance people don't understand, and insurance people think that tech people don't understand. And the truth is somewhere in the middle. And, you know, the best teams are balanced teams. And I think, you know, talking about how can a startup attract talent, it's about honesty and transparency. I think this is where people get into trouble, but this applies to big businesses as well. People will forgive you if you're lacking in certain elements. Like if you're joining a startup, you probably don't have the support you need. You might not even have all the tech that you need. You might not have the kind of numbers of people that you need, time in the day, and you're going to work hard and probably get paid less than you should do. That's fine, as long as we're upfront and honest. So one of the things that we do with our business is that we always tell people, you construct the pitch deck for your investors. Why have you not got a pitch deck which is specifically for your potential candidates to join your business? So, and what that is it's as honest and as raw as you can make it. You know, things like, what's your runway? And what's the, where are we going with this? Where do you see this in 5 years' time? You know, what are we good at? And what are we not so good at? Where do we have gaps? And if you've got that honest document, and if you can present it ahead of time, it doesn't become a problem down the line because people are not taken by surprise. So I think that more than anything is the most important thing. And then just to acknowledge that your job once you start a startup business is to always be recruiting, like constantly. I place people that I've known for 5 years when I've never had the right role for them. And then 5 years down the line, I find it. And the same is true of startups. I think you need to go to as many events as you can, as many meetups as you can. You need to kind of network on things like LinkedIn if it's possible to do so. And like all these things, it feels like a lot, but I think recruitment's like lifting weights at the gym. If you just decide, right, now we've got to hire, or now I've got to get fit for the gym and I'm going to go down there and I'm going to like make magic happen, it doesn't happen. You know, it's very difficult to do. But if you're connecting to 10, 20 people a day on LinkedIn that are relevant to you and your journey, or maybe you will be relevant down the line, when that opportunity comes and the right role comes and that person is in your network, then you're making your life a hell of a lot easier.
What do you find makes a really great business developer? Because this, by the way, would apply to the broking business, as you would call it, what we call a broker, You know, the same thing. What makes a great salesperson?
Yeah, people who are always trying to buy a Rolodex, right? That's what people try and hire, and I don't think it's relevant. You know, it's about tenacity. It's about having smart sales skills. It's knowing what a good sales process looks like. It's like knowing what a good methodology looks like, and you know, knowing how hand in hand sales goes with the rest of the business. Now, the best salespeople I know are involved in product conversations, they're involved in marketing conversations, they're involved in kind of strategic planning conversations, because again, I think the way that we buy has changed. I think what we're looking for is that genuine consultative sales. I think consultative sales has been overused as a term, because it's been almost kind of like co-opted to mean selling but not aggressively. and I don't think that's true. I think you can sort of aggressively consultatively sell, but gone are the days where it was about just jumping on the phone, because we now know all the information that we need to know is pretty much at our fingertips. So getting on a call without a why for your client, you know, you want to be open-minded, but you at least want to have an idea as to why your service and or your product is of value, and then you need to be able to follow a process. And you know, the best people I meet quite often surprise me that they're incredibly successful in sales. So some of it's a bit hidden. You know, they always come across like really slick.
They always interview well. Alex, sales is one of the highest turnover positions at tech companies, because they interview so well. They sell themselves so well, and then they come into your organization and often underperform so badly. You know,
but some of that's a two-way street, because they have to take on face value what the product can do, and particularly if they're in a sector where they're not as knowledgeable. And then there's this like, right, we're selling some, I don't know, claims software, and we're selling it to carriers, but we don't know that actually all the carriers are in 3-year deals with this like massive tech company that actually dominates the market, and you can't sell it. And the most,
which
the
is
most
by the way, of, why I don't sell claim software to carriers, by the way, that's
exactly right. You know that, but there are people out there trying to build claim software to sell to carriers, and they probably don't know that. And then they get the salesperson and go, we can't sell. And it's like, well, no, it's because no one can sell. I mean, I liken it to this. My friend of mine used to work in pharmaceutical sales. And in the UK, obviously, we would have National Health Service. So if you want to sell pharmaceuticals, you have to sell to the National Health Service. So he would have his like clutch of, they have these trusts, which is like they group hospitals together and they'll be in a trust. And he had his target list of trust to sell this one drug, and the NHS just blanket went, for these trusts, we're not buying that drug. And sometimes you can be, he's a great sales guy, but he's like,
yeah, you can't.
He's in a market where he's got certain clients and none of them will buy it. And I think you're right. Of course you're right. You know, salespeople are better at selling themselves in interviews than most people. Interviews are set up for people that like to talk, who can communicate well and tell stories. That's what interviews are, is a swapping of stories. And so, yeah, more often than not, they underperform against that story. But I do think there's plenty of good people that fall between the cracks, because they buy into the company and actually it's a product that can't be sold. But that's where referencing becomes important. That becomes, you know, if this person's done that 3 times in a row, then you kind of got to worry about their judgment anyway. I think that's why you have to take the whole history into account. You're allowed a couple of misfires that you can blame on the company, and then it's definitely about you.
Yeah, no, I it makes sense. You know, biz dev, sales. I will say I've met a ton of founders. Some are very effective at selling their company, but just as many, in my experience, more than other startups, like the founder actually isn't the most effective salesperson for his or her company. Definitely something that founders, I think, often have a blind spot in terms of how effective they are and versus getting, like you said, folks that are really qualified in enterprise sales, things like that. I'm curious, what are more broadly, like what are the biggest lies that founders tell themselves about recruiting?
Look, to be a founder, you've got to be really passionate and you've got to really believe you're going to be successful. And I think one of the biggest lies that people tell themselves when they're recruiting is that people coming into the business have to care about the business as much as you do. Because it's not possible. They're not a co-founder. They don't have the stake that you do. It's not their baby, you know, like I think most of the problems and the lies actually stem from that one instance. Another big one is that, you know, oh, we only hire the best of the best of the best. And then they're not using any external recruitment support. They're hiring from within their own network. Can't possibly be true. But and I know we're going to talk about that as a standalone thing, so I'm not going to dive into that too much.
No, go for it. That was going to be my next question. Go for it.
Yeah. Well, I want to just come back to the sort of business owner thing as well, though, because I think it's in line with the selling question. Like, so the best people at sales actually listen more than they sell. And I think when you're trying to sell to talent, you need to listen. Like, it's mostly about my job is mostly about listening to what people truly want and trying to read between spending enough time with them, asking enough questions that I go, okay, in this next move, this person wants X, Y, Z. And it could be more freedom. It could be more flexibility. It's very rarely about money. It's almost always about some sort of personal mission. And the example I would use is this, right? So let's say you've got there's a few insurtechs coming out now that are tackling climate change and using insurance as a vehicle, you know, whether it's kind of related to kind of carbon capture or something like that. So the mission is actually tackling climate change. But some of them are using really, really advanced machine learning and analytics. If you're an engineer joining that business, your mission personally might be to advance the use of machine learning and artificial intelligence just as a tool. But they're selling you on this climate change agenda and it just might not resonate with you at all. So I think that is the biggest lie anyone tells themselves is that everyone's doing this for the same reason that I am. And we talk lots about missions and people have to be on the mission. And look, I understand that people do need to pull in the same direction, but that direction just needs to be forward. And it doesn't matter if they're doing it for slightly different reasons. Like, you know, they all want to get home from the space shuttle. It doesn't matter, like, if their reasons are different to yours, as long as we're going back to Earth. You know, that's the kind of, like, the sort of lazy analogy I like to use. I could do a whole monologue for about an hour on this, I think. But it's particularly insidious at the moment because, you know, everyone's obviously rightly trying to address diversity, equity, inclusion imbalances, particularly with the insurance industry. Tech's slightly better, but not much. Insurance is particularly bad. I think like 70, there's some like the statistics are staggering, which is like essentially there's more women working in insurance than there are men, but there's this minuscule percentage of businesses that are led by women. The same for women getting investment, you know, women trying to start insurtechs are getting very little investment. And so we're seeing the same challenges. So people are kind of rightly starting new insurtech businesses and then saying like, this is key, this is important to us, this is a driver for us. And then they're also saying that we get the best and the best of the best talent. But then you talk to those businesses, and my job is to talk to these businesses every day. It's like, where are you getting your talent from? Oh, internal referrals or referrals from our investors. Now, if we're saying the investor pool is not very diverse, and it isn't, it probably looks like us three on this call, which is, you know, a bunch of middle-aged white guys, right? That's the investor pool. And then if we're saying that that investor pool is favoring investing money in people that look like the three people on this call, and then you're using your networks and their networks to fill your talent pools, it is not possible that either you're getting the best of the best of the best because you don't know everybody. And it's definitely not possible that you're doing your best for DE&I, which is this is where it links back into these are the lies we're telling ourselves. Now, I'm not deluded. It's expensive to use people like me. It takes a certain period of time. It's a cash flow consideration more than anything else as well, because that money has to be paid, you know, upfront at that time. So I'm comfortable with that. But the delusion, I think, impacts the fact that people do anything about it. And there are practical steps that people can take to do something about it. But if they're deluding themselves that going, we're getting the best of the best of the best, and we're solving our kind of diversity, equity, and inclusion with our selection, they're actually not addressing it, and they're never going to address it because they're not putting the foundations down to kind of address it in their process, in their procedures. Yeah, just it, I have to kind of draw the line between getting too angry about it, but it really, really drives me up the wall.
So you're saying that they got the best of the best of their network.
Exactly.
Yes.
And probably not even that. Probably not even that. Let's be honest. Like you it's the best people in their network that happen to want to move job at that point in time, that also happen to want to kind of do the mission that you're on.
So, interesting conversation. Great. Thanks for the news, Rob. And Alex Bond, cousin to James Bond, thank you for being on our show. Really appreciate you being here.
No, thank you, Jess. I really enjoyed talking to you, and it's nice to be on the other end of the podcasting. So thank you
It
very
is.
much.
On episode 89 of the InsurTech Geek podcast, talking about AI-powered business process intelligence with Jay Bartow from Zeitworks. Jay, how's it going?
Good. How are you guys?
Man, I cannot complain. Glad to have you on the show. So you've had a lot of different roles at a lot of different companies. One of them was acquired. You were CTO and co-founder of Vodo, which was acquired by Hulu. And I've been a longtime Hulu customer. So but you started in software industry. It's always been in software, technology development, CTO, managing director. Now you've been board member and advisor. Tell me what was the path there? Like, were you just always really interested in writing code and it didn't matter which industry?
It wasn't just code, and it didn't matter what industry. I got interested in two things in the late 90s: startups and machine learning and AI. I got introduced to those things through some faculty at University of Washington I was working with, on one of their startups. Some faculty was doing some spin-outs of their research into the private sector, and got really interested in pattern recognition and data and all these things I probably would have laughed at myself at 10 years earlier, being interested in this kind of stuff. But once I was on that startup path and that machine learning path, I ended up, going through a number of different verticals like e-commerce and online advertising, travel, medical informatics, consumer shot video. All of those things have interesting data and machine learning problems associated with it. So my thing is like creating these vertical machine learning products that take in some kind of interesting proprietary source of data, pull some signals out of it, and pass the value on to the customer.
Awesome. And let's fast forward then. Is Zeitworks your first foray into insurance technology?
Almost. So after I sold my last startup to Hulu, and worked at Hulu for a bit, I took an interesting job that kind of was reflected my background to some degree. I took a job as CTO and managing director at a startup studio. Basically, we were a small group of people in Seattle who our job was to come up with new, interesting, venture-backable technology startup ideas. And so we looked quite a bit at the insurance space, looking for new opportunities, new products that were needed, new technology that was needed, and so forth. So that's kind of the first time I started to learn a bit about insurance and insurtech. That was also the place where, looking at the RPA space, we came up with the idea for Zeitworks.
You had the opportunity with Zeitworks to take the set of tools that you described to me as upstream of RPA and apply them to any industry. So why'd you pick fintech and insurtech to be the first foray with
Yeah,
Zeitworks?
so the interesting thing, the nice thing about Zeitworks is that our total addressable market is massive, right? I mean, repetitive business processes executed by teams of people are found in so many industries: financial services, insurance, healthcare, manufacturing. I mean, you name it. So that's good from a total addressable market space. As a young little startup, we have to focus. We don't want to boil the ocean. And so financial services and insurance were particularly interesting to us. We chose fintech and insurtech on the bet that because we're a little startup, we got to move pretty quickly. And so when we engage customers, ideally, you know, it's a few months of, you know, getting in there, showing our value proposition and getting them onboarded as customers. Whereas a lot of the other industries I mentioned, you know, the sales cycle can be really long, and long sales cycles kill startups. And so, you know, that's kind of why we've been focused on, you know, the insurtechs and fintechs. You know, in order to hopefully move a little quicker, also be working with folks that maybe might be a little bit more versed in the value of data and how to work with data, you know, to optimize their businesses and, you know, make more analytical decisions about how to run their businesses and make them more efficient.
Awesome. So in a short, sweet, simple nutshell, what does Zeitworks actually do and how is it different than RPA?
So what we discovered from looking at RPA was before you can implement an RPA bot, you have to know what your process is. You have to understand it. You have to know what the steps are in the process. Is the process ready for RPA? Does it need to be re-engineered? Does it need to be optimized? And what we found was that although there was a big RPA boom happening at the time we started looking at the space in 2019, when we talked with a lot of customers in the spaces I mentioned, what we heard was, I've heard about RPA, I've heard about it from my colleagues, I've heard about it at the conferences. We're not ready for RPA. We got to figure out what's happening in our own group of people. I'm not sure what my people do. I'm not sure what processes they follow. I'm not sure what steps they follow. I'm not sure who's a good worker and a not so good worker. I'm not sure who needs help, et cetera, et cetera. And so we wanted to, we realized we needed to meet organizations where they are versus where they want to be, you know, at some point in the future. And that means, you know, shining a light on their organizations and their processes. And, you know, helping them see what's going on so they can fix it and make it better.
I'm really interested in this, Jay, because I've worked with RPA both at a couple different carriers that I've worked for in the past. And, you know, the promise is great. And to your point, we've got tons of workflows, some of which are automated, many of which are not, right? Manual processes. And I think the pandemic has shed a light on a lot of the manual parts. For insurance companies, you've talked about Zeitworks being a process fitness tracker. So tell me a little bit about how that works, where you're able to actually uncover what people do without them having to sit down and kind of interview them for hours about what they do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that was really the sort of initial problem we saw when we heard from management consulting firms in particular who work with RPA vendors that in order as a pre-step to RPA, they would need to sit down with their clients and do this manual process discovery and run these workshops where they would bring in gaggles of fresh college grads and have these kids stand over the shoulders of the workers, you know, doing the repetitive business processes and writing everything down manually. And that was time consuming. It was expensive. And it at the end of that exercise really only revealed a single point in time analysis. You know, processes are always changing. People are always changing. And so we knew we needed a system that could, a sensor, if you will, in our case, a software sensor, but conceptually certainly similar to a hardware sensor that, you know, you guys are starting to see in the insurance business, you know, people putting sensors in their homes and so forth and trying to notice and predict water damage and other things that can happen. In our case, we wanted to build a software sensor that would sit on the desktop machines of the information workers and passively monitor all of the interactions that they have with the user interface that made up their business process. So what applications did they interact with? In what order? How long would they spend in those applications? What would they do in those applications? And by being able to gather that data, you know, suddenly, you know, you can start to see things that you may never have thought of before. We've had customers who have said, you know, some of this stuff, you're validating my hunches that I've had for years. We've had those same customers have also said to us, hey, you know, I had no idea this was going on. I didn't know people were doing this or not doing this. And so, you know, one of our mottos is you can't fix what you can't see. And so with data, you know, suddenly, and some analysis on top of that data, suddenly you can see what's going on in a very similar way to all of us who are, you know, with our Apple Watches and our Fitbits and all this, you know, other sensor software we're starting to wear. Suddenly you've got the data. How many steps did I take today? How much weight did I lose? And once you have real data, I think we all know that you can make a lot better strategic decisions about where you want to go.
I got to ask the obvious question. Are you big?
It's a great question. And it's a deep question. You know, we, you know, are certainly sensitive to this topic of surveillance. And, you know, one of the things that we think is really important is that if you're going to be measured by something or someone, then you should be able to get value out of that measurement yourself personally. And so, you know, from a go-to-market standpoint, we focused on selling into managers and then their bosses, which are typically CIOs or CROs or so forth. But we've realized that if the whole team can be involved in the value of Zeitworks, both getting value out of Zeitworks and contributing to the value of Zeitworks, then the whole system is going to be better. So we really want our customers to be transparent, that there's a sensor running, but also give the information workers a login to our system where they can see their own metrics and they can see their own steps and use our tools to you know, figure out where they're having problems or debug their problems and be a part of that whole ecosystem. So we feel pretty strongly about that. And the first rev of features were for managers, but now we're starting to focus on features for workers too. You know, I think we only sort of know by instinct and analogy that when a worker is armed with information, no matter what kind of worker they are, they're more in a position to advocate for themselves. You know, one thing that we hear a lot about is, well, I do a really good job, and at promotion time, you know, I have data to back up the fact that, you know, I do a certain amount of work that, you know, yields a percentage of the teamwork that we need to accomplish in this quarter, or those kinds of things.
Okay, so let's talk about how you said it's upstream. Yes. from RPA. So let's talk about how far upstream, because it would seem to me like the next logical thing would be to automatically build an RPA bot from a process that you recorded, almost like recording an Excel macro. And I'm really sorry if I'm oversimplifying this, but it would seem to me like that might be a next step, right?
And, you know, as we, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we started out thinking that what was really needed was a way to automate what's called task discovery. So that you can understand, well, what are the steps I'm going to need to teach my bot in order to do this process? And then, as I mentioned, you know, we realized there was this sort of bigger problem of help me manage my team, help me understand, you know, where we are and how to optimize things prior to RPA. But it's logical to think, okay, well, there'll be a time where Zeitworks helps a team get their house in order and figure out their processes and understand how well engineered they are and whether they're good candidates for RPA. And at that point, you know, we have all the data. We can certainly output a process map or a task map, if you will, you know, that would be instructional either to automatically create an RPA bot or probably more likely instructions to give an RPA engineer to go and implement, you know, a bot. You know, one of the metrics we compute is a complexity score on a process, and not all executions of one particular process are the same. So someone may be processing bank loans, and, you know, James, maybe, you know, your bank loan application is not so complicated, but Rob's is more complicated for whatever reason. And so it's not a one size fits all when it comes to these processes, and being able to observe a whole distribution of process executions, say in this case, you know, a bank loan process, you know, really tells a much greater story of how complicated do these things get. And, you know, given that and where there's complications, you know, what is the most appropriate use of RPA technology?
Well, that's a good discussion. So I'll finish out with this. What's long term? What's on the horizon?
Yeah, you know, a lot of things on the horizon. You know, one of the things that, interestingly enough, I think that is probably on the horizon for us is that, in some sense, all roads do lead back to automation. And so, you know, we see some processes where there are parts to it where you need a human. They're looking at a Word doc. They're interpreting some unstructured text as an important step in that process, and using their heads to figure out, okay, what do I do next? Oftentimes there's other parts of the same process that are highly repetitive. For example, copying and pasting values from, you know, a web screen into an Excel spreadsheet. Of course, Excel spreadsheets are ubiquitous. They're the glue that holds together the pieces oftentimes between all these different processes. We recognize that the idea of, I'll call them micro automations, pieces of the automation of the process that can be automated, you know, for an information worker, and pieces of the process that just need to be done by the worker. So the analogy I use a lot for this is autonomous driving. I think we maybe were led to believe that autonomous driving would be, you know, ubiquitous and powerful by now. I can tell you as a Tesla owner, it's not. It works great on the highway. But when you get into the city, man, you better have your hands on the wheel. And so I think the same thing is true here. You know, we're obsessed with thinking that AI is going to replace things and take over things, when in fact, I think a much better role for AI and machine learning is in an assistive or augmentative role, where it's helping you along and doing those, in this case, very repetitive parts. But in other parts, it's, you know, it's backing off and letting the human do what the human does well.
You know, this really goes well with my favorite book on Lean, 2 Second Lean. He says his primary suggestion in implementing Lean is to take a video of your process before and after, so you can show people how much improvement there was. Yeah. Do y'all actually log video so you can actually see a video of how someone did it before and then show a video of how they do it after?
You know, we do grab screenshots, we try to minimize how many screenshots we grab. It helps us with our machine learning when we train our models to find processes being executed in the wild. But there's also, again, utility for the end user. And I think that's a great example of, like, here's where we started. And now, you know, we've analyzed, we've measured, and we've made changes, and we're iteratively improving, you know, in a lean style fashion to get better and better. But you got to know where you came from in order to measure your progress.
It's been a good show. Jay Bartow, really enjoyed talking
to you.
Really
appreciate it.
You can go to their website. That would be zeitworks.com, I believe. And you can go to ZEITWORKS, zeitworks.com. Thanks, Jay, and thanks, Rob, for being on the show.
Thanks, gentlemen.
We'll see you next week.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
This has been the InsurTech Geek podcast, powered by JB Knowledge. That's jbknowledge.com. It's all about transforming and disrupting the insurance world. I've been your host, James Benham. That's jamesbenham.com with co-host Rob Galbraith. That's endofinsurance.com. Big thanks to Jim Greenlee, our podcast producer, Kara Dalton-Alaro, our creative producer. And thank you for joining us today. We're taking you on a journey through insurance tech. So enjoy the ride and geek out. See you next time.